I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
This is all about trust now and personal responsibility and just being careful and not being selfish.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it.
The idea of an irreversible move was taken off the table. You can't do that when you have no idea where the virus is going to go.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. The UK has lost its positive virus streak. The number of new COVID cases has risen for the first time in a week. But despite the increase in cases, the seven-day average is still down from the previous week.
But as the cases seem to be ticking up again, concerns are being raised about the government's decision to further ease restrictions for EU and US travellers. Senior officials have warned the Cabinet that letting travellers enter freely might raise the risk of lower quality vaccines undermining Britain's immunity.
And Labour is claiming that the relaxation could allow a new variant to spread through the country. The party is also demanding clarity on what progress has been made on reaching reciprocal agreements with other countries. Transport Secretary Grant Shapps is expressing hope that the US will become more relaxed about allowing Brits to visit in time.
But of course, those rules are specifically in reference to England. It doesn't apply to Scotland necessarily, and Scotland may have its other views on this. Let's explore some of this with Katie Clark, who's Scottish Labour member of the Scottish Parliament for the West Scotland region. Katie, welcome to the programme and thank you for being with us. We are seeing once again kind of divisions between the way that Scotland and England are handling the reopening of society post-pandemic. From your point of view, isn't Nicola Sturgeon the one who's getting it right, or is it more Boris Johnson?
Well, I think Nicola Sturgeon's getting it more right. There's still mistakes being made in Scotland, but I think most people in Scotland, you know, view what's happening down south as being quite an irresponsible way to approach this pandemic. And most people, you know, believe it's correct that we've still got the legal requirement to have masks and for social distancing in Scotland. There is a contrast between the way that Scotland and England are approaching matters at the moment, and I think it's fair to say there's a more cautious approach in Scotland.
In terms of the rules on foreign travel, isn't it a little bit impractical for Scotland to have its own rules? There's a pretty long, porous border. I mean, if somebody flies into Newcastle and then gets the train up to Edinburgh, it's quite tricky to stop that, isn't it?
Well, I think that's right. It is very difficult. I mean, people, you know, travel regularly down south to go abroad, to, you know, to fly from Manchester, to fly from Newcastle, or indeed to fly from the London airport. So we do need a consistency of approach. But, you know, it's absolutely right that Scotland has its own rules and those need to be enforced. But, you know, as I say, I think most people in Scotland feel a more cautious approach is the way that we should be going. And I think the concerns that are being raised about new variants developing are ones that we've got to take very, very seriously, because as we know, this pandemic, unfortunately, is still not over. And, you know, the risk of new variants is a very real one.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about Scotland, you know, having handled it more cautiously, but in fact, it's not that long ago, only a few weeks, when Scotland, according to the World Health Organization, had one of the highest incidences in Europe, I think specifically, of the Delta variant. So the greater caution north of the border doesn't necessarily always pay off, does it?
No, and as I say, many mistakes have been made. And, you know, whilst, as I say, at the moment, there's a more cautious approach in terms of relaxation of the restrictions, there's been many, many mistakes made in Scotland too, in terms of how the pandemic has been handled, in terms of, you know, patients being released from hospitals into care homes. There's been a lot of operational issues around about the vaccination programme and a lot of inconsistencies in approach, which have, you know, really led a lot of people to feel that they don't necessarily agree or respect some of the restrictions if they feel that they're not fair. So, as I say, it's far from perfect in Scotland. And as you say, we've also got very, very high COVID levels, which I think is the reason why most people feel that we should be cautious with, you know, relaxation of requirements on masks and social distancing, because the pandemic is still very much here and we've got very high COVID levels. And as we know, you know, we're seeing people hospitalised and indeed we're still seeing deaths. So, you know, I think that's the concern that most people have, is that the pandemic, frankly, just isn't over yet. And therefore, it's a bit early to be going down the path of such major relaxation.
So you think the response has been better north of the border than it has been at Westminster. But what are your criticisms of Nicola Sturgeon? How would Labour do things differently in Scotland?
Well, I think at the moment, I mean, you know, I think one of the issues is the inconsistency. Another issue, I think, is issues around about delivery in terms of the vaccination programme, indeed, for a long time in terms of testing, that I think, you know, some of the time Scotland was lagging behind. So in terms of some of the operational issues, I think there's genuine concern. But many of the issues that constituents raise with me is actually about the inconsistency in the rules. You know, why is it fair, for example, for adults to go to fan zones during football tournaments, but it's not fair for parents to attend a ceremony at their children's nursery for graduation or an event at their school? You know, so I think a lot of the inconsistencies, particularly between adults and children, are some of the things that really leads people to not respect the rules. And it's all very well having things in law, you know, that you've got to wear masks, that there's got to be social distancing. But unless the population is actually complying with those regulations, then they're not going to work. And so therefore, I think a lot of the concerns have been about some of the inconsistencies, which I think probably have meant that more people are not actually respecting some of the restrictions there are in terms of social distancing with friends and family. So, you know, I think there have been mistakes made in Scotland, but, you know, when you compare it to what's happened down south, I think most people feel that the Boris Johnson government is really making decisions based on the views of, you know, backbench Tory MPs rather than the interests of the general public. And these are political decisions about what you can get through the House of Commons rather than, you know, what's actually in the public interest, or indeed what the science would tell you is the right thing to do. And, you know, I can quite understand as a politician why Boris Johnson doesn't want to get legislation through the House of Commons on the back of Labour MPs' votes. But really, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, it's really quite shameful seems to be a major consideration in terms of major public policy decisions.
But Katie, this rather crystallises the problem that your party has, whether it's north or south of the border, is that you're stuck between two. I mean, in terms of Scotland, you're in a position where you do not command majority support. That was clear from recent elections. You clearly don't back the SNP, nor the Conservatives, nor the Liberal Democrats. And you can't really affect policy very much. Why has your party failed to break through in Scotland in the way historically, of course, it dominated?
Yeah, well, I think you've articulated the frustrations of opposition and, you know, and why Labour so much wants to get into a position where we're able, you know, to make these decisions and to have more influence, as you say. And Labour really hasn't recovered from the, you know, the 2014 independence referendum in Scotland. You know, that was a long campaign in Scotland. It went on for almost 2.5 years. And politics really has become polarised around about the constitutional issue in Scotland. So at the recent, you know, election for the Scottish Parliament, whatever criticisms people might have of the SNP government, whatever failings they may have felt that there was in terms of aspects of public policy, at the end of the day, most people seem to vote on constitutional grounds. And therefore, you know, the number of people who would see themselves as being in favour of independence who voted for the SNP, you know, actually went up. And people were voting for one of the other parties, you know, the Liberals, the Tories, Labour, it was often because of the constitution. And that's a really unhealthy place for Scotland to be in, you know, when we've got such major challenges facing us, not just in terms of the pandemic, but in terms of, you know, the economic crisis that we're about to face, and indeed in the crisis in public services. You know, we've got huge poverty and deprivation and inequalities in Scotland which need to be challenged, addressed, and we need a Labour government, you know, to be doing that. And as you say, it's hugely frustrating for us that we're not able to get our voice heard. And I believe in Scotland, you know, the primary reason is that Labour just simply hasn't recovered from that independence campaign, and communities are polarised on the constitutional issue.
Interesting what you say about that. About half of Scots are still in favour of remaining in the union, give or take. Why is Labour failing to mop up those votes? If Labour got all of those votes, then you'd be in a pretty strong position. But a lot of them seem to be going to the Conservatives these days. Why is Labour losing its grip on the unionist vote?
Well, I don't see Scotland in terms of a unionist vote or a vote in favour of independence in the way that you see. I mean, I didn't come into politics myself because of the constitutional issue. I came because I wanted to see you know, social change. I wanted to see the empowerment of working class communities and the eradication of poverty. And if you look at what happened in working class communities during the referendum, if they became polarised on grounds of the constitution, and many of them went yes. And therefore, many of the communities that Labour historically represented no longer looked to Labour because of the constitutional issue. And therefore, you know, many people who would have voted Labour before in working class communities are not doing so. And what you're suggesting to me as well, what you've got to do is, if you like, go and, you know, get more support amongst, you know, the ruling class, yeah, more affluent parts of society. And that may well be a way of mocking up votes. I'm not convinced it would work in the way that you suggest, because I don't think the numbers are there. But it's not actually what Labour's about. It's not what Labour was created to do. Labour was created to be to work for and to be a voice for working class communities. And that's the challenge, if you like, that Labour faces in Scotland, but Katie, don't see yourself just as being about the constitution.
But briefly, Katie, there's a really big challenge, which is who your leader is, because you keep changing your leaders. I mean, isn't part of the problem that people know about Nicola Sturgeon, people know about Boris Johnson, they don't really know who's leading Labour in Scotland?
I think Anas is doing well. I think people are, you know, people do know who Anas Sarwar is. He's only been in the position a very short period of time. But, you know, Labour's problems in Scotland, if you like, aren't to do with who our leader is. You know, we can, you know, as you say, we've changed the leader a number of times, but hasn't led to, you know, Labour doing significantly better. It's about what we're saying, how we orientate ourselves,
right,
and whether we're actually able to offer a vision.
Okay. But now let's talk about what other stories there are making the world news in the world of politics. And Google is being sued over claims that it overcharged nearly 20 million British customers for App Store purchases. The claimants say Google Play Store's 30% surcharge for digital purposes is, quote, excessive and unfair. Now, the case, which is being brought at the Competition Appeal Tribunal, says Google breached European and UK competition laws at the expense of millions of loyal customers. Well, a Google spokesperson said the case ignores the benefits and choice Google Play and its Android operating system provide and the competitive market in which it operates.
And Northern Ireland could become a permanent casualty of Brexit unless disputes around the protocol are resolved. That's according to a House of Lords committee. It warns that both sides have fundamentally flawed approaches to the hampering efforts to find a solution. But the report also says many businesses see the protocol as a competitive advantage that could boost jobs and growth. That's because it makes Northern Ireland the only part of the UK able to trade with the EU, just as it did before Brexit.
Now, more than £860 million is going to be invested in flood protection schemes across the country over the next year. The government says the plan will reduce the national flood risk by up to 11% by 2027, and it will protect around 336,000 homes and businesses, as well as help avoid up to £3.2 billion in economic damage. It comes as heavy rainfall over the last few days has caused disruption from Scotland to London, with the Met Office putting both yellow and amber weather warnings in place.
Let's take a deep dive now into the issue of teachers' pay. According to analysis by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the pay freeze for teachers in England announced for this year will leave wages about 8% lower in real terms than they were in 2007, just before the financial crisis. Pay for less experienced teachers doing a little bit better, that will be about 4 to 5% lower than in 2007. The IFS research, supported by funding from the Nuffield Foundation, says the numbers represent declines relative to average earnings. The Department of Education says it remains committed to increasing the teacher starting salary to £30,000, but given the public finances, progress towards this commitment will be slower. Well, joining us now to discuss this is Luke Sibieta, Research Fellow at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Luke, thanks so much for joining us. Talk us through your key findings on teachers' pay.
Well, I think you've given a very nice summary there. So looking back over the period since the financial crisis, teacher pay has fallen by about 8% more experienced teachers. And that encompasses a small real terms fall during the financial crisis, but a big fall during the period of cuts from 2010 to 2014 in particular, where there was a big drop in teacher pay. However, it still hasn't quite kept pace with inflation over the last few years, and that's led to this 8% decline over the entire period. And as a result, teacher pay has fallen behind average earnings, even since the financial crisis, and that means that the teacher labour market is under quite severe stress, and retention rates of teachers has been falling for quite a number of years.
And Luke, I mean, I guess the big comparison then is really going to be with other people in the public sector, the police, nurses, etc. And how do they fare in that regard?
Well, in the latest year, so there's been a pay freeze across most of the public sector for this current year. That encompasses teachers, the police, and most of the public sector workers. However, there's been a pay rise for individuals in the NHS. So the staff in the NHS have been kind of accepted from this pay freeze, which is kind of leading to starting to open up a gap between those who work in the NHS in the public sector and those who don't.
Just talk us through, in actual terms, what most teachers earn, because I think a lot of people, even people with kids, won't really be clear on what their teachers are getting paid. Talk us through starting salaries and what teachers can expect to earn as they go on in their careers.
Outside of London, the starting salary for teachers is around £25,700 in England. And that rises to about £41,000 for teachers at the top of the pay scale. So it's sort of in the similar ballpark to most other graduates, but it has been falling behind in recent years, and that's led to other careers being more attractive for young graduates. And what's also interesting is that it's falling behind starting salaries in other parts of the UK. So whilst pay has been frozen in England this year, it's been increasing in Wales and Scotland. So the starting salary for a teacher in Wales is around £27,000, and due to increase a bit more in September. And in Scotland, it's around £27,500. So we're not now starting to see a difference in starting salaries for teachers across the UK.
But Luke, we're hearing a lot in the wider economy that there are lots of unfilled places in various industries. Hospitality, I suppose, is the obvious one, but many others. Are we going to reach a point where teachers are hard to recruit because they can get better pay and better conditions elsewhere?
Well, that may be where we're going to. The pay freeze and kind of restraint on pay this year makes some sense given the stress on the labour market in it, and some of the pressures on the teacher labour market have been eased during the pandemic, as you might expect, because outside opportunities are few and far between. But it's kind of only gone back to where it was a few years ago. And if a global crisis and pandemic can't correct for the fact that difficulty in the teacher labour market, it suggests that more significant action will be needed if we're not going to move to a situation when economic recovery hopefully takes place. And other opportunities just look more attractive for would-be teachers.
Because we've heard that phrase, a recruitment crisis, from the unions for years, many years. Is there a recruitment crisis, or is it just... what is the recruitment situation like in the teaching profession?
So the situation is that things have been gradually getting worse year on year for the last 10, 15 years. And that's partly due to the fact that pay has been quite heavily restrained for the last 10, 15 years. But we've kind of missed the fact that the things are getting a little bit worse each year, that over the period of the whole thing, they've got a lot worse. And we're now in a situation where probably barely two-thirds of teachers are still in the profession 5 years after training. That makes training teachers incredibly expensive and puts huge stress on the market. And where we're having most problems is in secondary schools. And things are kind of okay in primary schools, but still not perfect. But in secondary schools, in particular in math, science and languages subjects, recruitment targets have been missed year on year for at least 5 years and probably longer. And that's making it hard to recruit specialists in those subjects, and meaning those teachers who are, if you're a physics teacher in a school, you're probably under huge demand and spread incredibly thinly across the school.
And I suppose particularly those sort of skills, maths and science, could very well be skills that could be sold elsewhere more easily, perhaps, than, I don't know, history or geography.
Well, exactly. It's not a huge surprise that subjects in, like, maths, science, physics are the ones where we have most difficulty recruiting teachers, because they're the areas where graduates can get the best salaries outside of teaching. Before the pandemic, there was a move to put in retention centres in those subjects, but they were quite limited, and it probably more radical action is needed to try and keep teachers in those subjects, because suggest that they're the areas where we have most difficulty.
Is there evidence of turnover increasing? Are more teachers leaving the profession than they were perhaps 10 years ago?
Well, the exit rate of teachers from the profession has been gradually creeping up over time for the last 10 years. It's kind of about 1 in 10 teachers leave each year. But a much larger share of those is now people just leaving the profession during their working lives rather than retirement, which is what the norm was 10 years ago. So there's more people moving out of teaching during their career, which creates the need to get more people into the profession and puts a lot more stress on the market. So more teachers are leaving. That went down during the pandemic, as you kind of would expect. But there are already signs that teachers are kind of stressed, well, seriously stressed and overworked during the pandemic, and that's leading to intentions to leave in the next few years.
And I suppose, taking it to the other end of all this, what about the pension issue? Because teachers, part of the teachers' pension scheme, it's a pretty good scheme, really, most people seem to think. But is that the kind of thing that really will keep people working there when perhaps otherwise they might leave?
Well, the teacher pension scheme is undoubtedly very generous and a very, very significant part of remuneration, but it's obviously quite delayed. And the extent to which it attracts people will depend on the extent to which it's important in their mindset. It's a big part of remuneration and a big part of what people will earn as a teacher. So hopefully it should attract people. But the contribution rate of people going into the teaching pension scheme have increased, and that is obviously a generous scheme, but it will reduce take-home pay as well.
How much would pay need to increase, would you say, to get teachers back on a level with other workers in the NHS,
well,
for instance?
So the if we were to say, just compare to average earnings, the government's already committed to put in starting salaries of £30,000 by 2023 now. So immediate manifesto commitment about 1 year late. That would mean the starting salaries are probably above the growth in average earnings for the last few years. So that would be a significant commitment. However, that still doesn't correct for the 8% drop in average earnings over the last 14 years, and we calculate that teacher pay would probably need to rise by something in the order of about 13%
wow.
over the next 2 years in order to put it on a par with the changes in average earnings.
Yeah.
So that would be a very significant growth, but it would obviously require extra spending, and that's a problem.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.